Right now, it is time for the Media Beat with David Tarachuk. David joins us every Friday morning. Of course, you can find David at his own website, themediabeat.us. He's also a PBS television correspondent reporting on ethics and belief. Good morning, Dave.
Well, hello there. Good to be with you.
It's nice to have you with us this morning once again. And, you know, I haven't watched it. I haven't watched a bit of it, I have to say, because I don't like sitting there screaming at the TV, so I've stayed away from it. But the impeachment...
I wonder what it is that you're staying away from.
The impeachment...
You're talking about the impeachment trial hearing?
In the Senate, I mean...
the it of the week, yes. It is unbearable, I agree, but... Someone's got to watch it. The numbers are not great, but many people are watching it. And often, according to the to the Nielsen ratings, for long periods of time, too. So it cuts against the grain of our modern culture, I have to say. It challenges the short attention span that so many of us have been afflicted by because of the nature of communications as they've developed over the last two decades.
Well, you know, it's just that unlike other impeachment hearings, I mean, when you have the Republican leader in the Senate, the majority say that they're going to work their darndest to work with the White House. Well, I mean,
impartial jurors, they are not.
You could have the Democrats present a most perfect case coming out of the Congress, and it's just not going to move. Now, I could be wrong. Maybe they'll get four senators to allow witnesses, but I seriously doubt that. I mean, this is we're dealing with a whole different political animal now here, and it's not only in Washington. It seems to be a worldwide phenomenon. They're just in sides that are just not in any way, shape, or form try to cooperate with one another on even the slightest things.
Yeah, and broadening the context in a different direction, too, going back historically, just within the United States. It's worth remembering, of course, that we make a big hullabaloo about this being the third impeachment, only the third impeachment of a U.S. president in history ever. And, you know, not President Nixon in the 1970s, coming close to impeachment, but only escaping it by resigning. But the point is that it's a low number, and this is a very unique occasion. But the other point to remember about impeachment of other presidents is that none of them have been found guilty and acquitted. Found guilty and removed from office. They've all been narrowly acquitted, and narrowly or not, it's almost a foregone conclusion that this president will be acquitted too.
Yeah, but I think when you look at it, though, and one thing about the so-called stain of impeachment, it does still exist, because even though the ones that were acquitted, they're forever linked. Impeachment is forever linked with their names. And, of course, with Richard Nixon, the resignation is forever linked with his name. So the impeachment process, whether or not you get the conviction in the Senate or not, obviously is a way to fight back and show the President of the United States that there is an independent power.
Everyone in the media is so insistent on reminding us every day or every hour that this is not so much a legal process as a political process, and that applies to the state of the verdict. Of course, I mean, you're right. It's legally it's an acquittal, but the stain has already been applied. But then. You're dealing also with a Teflon Don, Donald J. Trump, and stains don't seem to matter too much to him.
No, I want to step out of Washington for a second and go to a very big story that is growing and growing and growing, and that is what started in China, in one province, the coronavirus is what they're calling. That is a
Corona,
story.
That is a story
that has yet to really reach this country. Even though there's one person that was confirmed in this country, this is going to turn into another one of these really big stories.
Very likely, unless it's contained, and you know, notoriously difficult it is to contain epidemics. The World Health Organization, with whom I worked for a bit when I was a UN guy, a media person, and the WHO is doing something very different this time in terms of public relations. They are assessing favorably and praising China's efforts to contain this epidemic in a way that in a way quite opposite to how they reacted to China's performance over their previous medical troubles, epidemics like SARS and such like have traditionally been dealt with in China with great secrecy. And that's very much not the case this time. It's remarkable to see how, in terms of media management and the like, for their own national audience, internally, domestically, the Chinese authorities have been very clear and very open. And the same goes for their international relations, too. They've been very cooperative with the WHO, and it's possible that while it may not be contained, the effect of this epidemic might be limited compared with what we've seen before. Let's hope so, because it's a very horrible, raging kind of, they say, flu-like symptoms, but that's a terribly minimizing kind of title. It has its fatalities, and strangely, uncharacteristically for these kinds of epidemics, it's even attacking and succeeding in attacking healthy young children, and that's something that is a rarity. And of course, like all epidemics, it will follow a certain course, and we've already seen one of the characteristics, which is that these epidemics will grumble along in a low grade spread to begin with, and then suddenly, as it has in the last 5 or 6 days, it'll suddenly shoot up, and that's the point we're at now.
I want to move on to Brexit, okay? Because, you know, as
you never seem to leave Brexit.
I know. It's
it weighs on our minds a lot, and it needs to, because it's an important change in world rankings. I mean, it's all too easy to, especially sitting in the United States, to dismiss the importance of this as some kind of internal European wrangle. But of course, it has enormous implications for the world trade economy, especially.
So anyways, it's going to go forward now. That question was answered by the election, but now it's going to go forward. But this is by no. Now the real negotiating begins, right? That when they break off, how clean and how firm of a break off it is.
Absolutely. Yep. January the 31st is the official day of Britain being released from membership. But what relationship are they going to have with Europe, and consequently with the rest of the world? America is Trump's America, especially the officials of this administration are very eager to negotiate an independent, you know, a one-on-one relationship with the UK. And that's worrying a lot of people in Britain. One of the things especially that they're worried about is that the vaunted National Health Service, what is decried here as socialized medicine, but something that the British public as a whole and crossing all party boundaries are very fond of, the National Health Service, is likely to be a battleground. American business and of course, the Commerce Department of the United States, which will be mainly in charge of negotiating with the British government, are determined to take advantage of the fact that Britain wants a one-on-one deal with the United States. And pharmaceutical companies are just itching to get hold of this huge market in Britain and have a free rein through it, whereas traditionally the National Health Service has been very, in classic economic terms, pretty controlling of things like prices and sources. That flies in the face of the sort of free-ranging capitalism that the Commerce Department will be wanting. And that's why there's this somewhat hysterical, but it has a foundation in reality. Hysterical treatment in the British media or some of the British media, about how the Americans are going to take over our precious National Health Service in Britain. So it's going to be a very emotional scene, as well as a sort of fairly bitter commercial contest going on.
God help you if I do. American, anything to do with American healthcare comes over there.
Yeah, and American pharmaceutical companies.
That's what I'm talking about.
More of the leadership getting jailed and fined, I see, in this country for their contributions to the opioid epidemic. But it's not an industry with a great popular reputation. Not that it ever did have, really. Except for now and again when they had resounding successes in miracle drugs. But otherwise, I think it's an industry that people don't have a very positive view about.
Another look I want to take in the streets of Baghdad this morning. There's close to 1 million people. And yes, there is militia there. It's not just normal people. There are three or four different militia groups that are also marching there as well. But one of the unintended consequences, once again, of that assassination was this demonstration now is totally anti-American and has nothing to do anymore with the plane that was brought down by Iranian missiles. But here's what also has happened. A lot of people didn't realize that for about 6 or 7 months, there were a lot of protests from young people, and they wanted the overhaul of the Iraqi government. That's now been eclipsed.
Absolutely, yeah, and that's merged now with the anti-American feeling. I mean, the Baghdadi government is only in place because of American power, and the whole thing is merged together. I mean, a very large part of that massive crowd demonstrating in Baghdad today will, in our heart of political hearts, identify with Iran. It's a pro-Iranian demonstration in many ways, but more than anything, it's an anti-American demonstration. The whole feel of Iraqi politics now has been hugely influenced by the assassination of Soleimani. Unsurprising for anyone who watches the Middle East. However, I think one person sitting in the Oval Office has been surprised. Not that that will make any difference to him, I don't suppose.
Getting back to what's happening in China, Joe just pointed out to me, and I didn't realize it was this many now, but 10 cities, 20 million people basically cannot leave their cities. Do you think the estrangement of the United States on the world stage will hamper progress in curtailing this from spreading, or do you think that this is even one thing that can get over that? I mean, you've got China, which is very secretive, and you've got the United States and the World Health Organization. There's the technology there. Can they all work together in the climate that we have now?
International cooperation has been taking a lot of knocks, mainly applied by this Trump administration. You're right, but it's a complex field, and one of the things that my former colleagues at the World Health Organization are saying, if under their breath, one thing you can do in China, which you can't do in many other societies, is be as absolutely ruthless in your containment efforts as they are. It's a society in which rules and control is applied. It's not a free society, and in a strange, ironical way, that helps in the control of disease. Victorian times, with the coming of an understanding about how disease was transmitted, meant that Victorian societies in the West, Britain and the United States, were incredibly repressive in controlling diseases. I'm thinking of cholera and the like. And they had to be. And sometimes measures taken in time of disease and epidemics can seem extremely oppressive. But it's arguably the case that this is absolutely necessary. And the combination of a well-oiled international health system, which we haven't got it 100%, but it's more effective now than it has been for decades. Plus the very firm controls that China itself is applying may be enough to contain this disease. But there are still going to be rough and ragged patches around the circumference of all of this, the rest of the world, those who pride themselves on being free societies will be a bit squeamish, I suspect, about applying the controls too tightly, and there will be exceptions, there will be mini outbreaks, and which could be turning, of course, into major outbreaks in Western countries too. So it's not going to be an easy matter, but I don't think it's helped enormously by the fact that this American administration is no longer in favor, generally speaking, of multilateral agreements and multilateral action. Make America great again also means that America is very isolated again. So it's a complex area, and it would be hard to really predict how it's going to go. But I think the chances are probably more on the side of containment than on the side of worldwide contagion.
I'm going to bring up something now, which I don't know if you, as a kid growing up, I was born in 1952. As a kid growing up, there was a thing that was in the news all the time called the Doomsday Clock, and it was a clock that was established to show how close humanity was to doomsday. Most of the time, when I was growing up, with the Cuban Missile Crisis and all that. It was like a minute, 2 minutes, 3 minutes. Also, during any situation where there's war, it's that way.
This was a metaphorical idea, yeah. Of course. There was no clock ticking away towards a specific time, but it was a kind of a barometer, if I can change the metaphor a little bit, a barometer of the nation's mood, right?
Of the world's mood, and now it's at the shortest time ever since. They've been doing this 100 seconds away from midnight, and it's due to unstable world conditions, but also they add to that the climate change and what's going on with the climate change added to that. I just think it's something that if you take anybody who's probably over younger than 50, have no idea what the doomsday clock is or how it's meant to show, it's meant to scare the bejesus out of people into action.
Sure, 1950s America had a sort of underlying paranoia that I don't think we would want to repeat, but it concentrated the mind for many people, that's true, and occasions when we came close to nuclear war, for instance, would sort of heighten that that tension and everyone's sort of dedication to survival would get heightened as well. And mercifully, you know, no nuclear buttons were pushed over all those decades from the 50s through till now. But that's not really the major threat to us now. Well, who knows? But the global warming threat, which has also been predicted for a long time, perhaps not as long as the doomsday clock has been was in existence, but certainly again from my United Nations work, I recall, and only yesterday I was with a colleague who dates back even further than me in the United Nations organization, and the part of it that he was concerned with was the population growth. Those people in the UN agency known as the UNFPA were sounding the alarm back in the 70s about growing world population was a problem, but alongside that they had to recognize that world's resources were at a severe risk because of what they were seeing already as a dangerous, though small at the time, rise in global temperatures. And my friend was saying only yesterday that we had no idea it could get so quickly. I mean, relatively quickly. We're several decades later now, but it's looming so much larger now. And again, you know, a degree of paranoia is not a bad thing. When the problem you're facing is as serious as it is,
and the retreat of the United States, even though one country can't do it alone, and the retreat from the United States from being a leader in trying to make the awareness of what's happening with our Earth to other countries and getting them
well,
on
of course,
board.
The reverse process inside. The United States, the idea that multilateralism is a thing of the past, and in some strange way America can and should go it alone, is a peculiarly vicious in the sense of being harmful to the whole idea of protecting the state of the world. You can't do something as innately multilateral as saving the world from frying itself to death in a single unilateral way. You just can't do it. Or a series of bilateral agreements with weaker countries around the world that you go into sort of bullying negotiation with, which is what this administration is trying to do everywhere, pretty well everywhere anyway. Multilateral problems, multinational problems need multilateral solutions, and that's what this administration has turned its back on.
I just want you to know I'm very proud of us. We've gone 20 some minutes without talking about the royal family.
I'm very proud of that too, now that you pointed out to me.
Well, we're going to play a little.
But to be perfectly honest, I don't spend much of my day thinking about the royal family.
I know. Most people.
Unlike some of our acquaintances.
And so now we're going to play a little game, and it's called Read Between the Lines.
Ah.
All right. I invented it watching
Sounds
this week.
Sounds like a good game to me.
Okay. So, a couple years ago, and I mentioned this to Marshall yesterday, because I can't get over it. A couple years ago, when Prince Bonesaw got busy, there was a rumor that the Saudis had hacked Jeff Bezos' phone, which essentially cost him, forget the Washington Post, cost him several billion dollars in a divorce proceeding, because that was that's what really happened. No, nothing like that.
Give us the lines we got to read between here.
This, because here we are. UN investigating Saudi phone hack. What else? It's like, here we are 2 years on, and guess what? That very thing that was dismissed out of hand turns out to be a factor
Oh, yeah, sure.
So, okay, Mr. Media. Okay, Mr. Media. So everyone's like, oh, let's look over here. Let's deal with this sort of, oh, how could this have happened? Well, the point is,
Chinese have been hacking technology off of phones and stuff like that
for years. But between the lines, it's like I haven't quite worked out the.
They keep their killings within the country, though.
I know, what's really striking? What's really striking about this news universe? Is how, depending on where you go, you can. It's now like going to a restaurant. Do you want Italian? I'm not meaning literally. It's like, what kind of food do you want? Do you want some sort of Asian fusion? And then you just go get the news that you want to go with your hunger of the day. It does nothing to inform anybody, and it's making me nuts.
Well, I'm not surprised. What we hanker after for is a consensus about what's important, and more importantly, a consensus on what is true.
How about that?
But unfortunately, we're living in a world where you get your news tailored to your taste, and that's what we're living with now.
But what's frustrating?
If we want the truth, we have to be even more vigilant than in the past, and go out deliberately to find it.
Yeah, but
it's not going to come neatly packaged to us anymore.
No, but the frustrating
by mainstream deliverers of these packages that we get every day. That's what I mean.
I guess the frustration is when it does come out, it's denied. No. This never happened. You must be insane for thinking this. And then
yeah, sure. And of course, you know, a denial is enough for so many.
Yeah.
Denials work very well with lazy journalists. That's the truth of the matter. And you know, the active journalists and energetic journalists who don't yield to laziness will continue the search. But they'll inevitably, in this fractured universe, they will be few and far between, these earnest journalists who carry on even in the face of official denials. And they're the ones who, you know, in this case, 2 years later, are proven right.
Well, we'll carry on next week.
Oh, I guess
we'll try and be
say
as earnest as we can be, yeah, and awake, and not lazy.
No, we aren't. All right. Thank you very much, David Sarachuk, the Media Beat.
Thank you.
And, of course, you can hear the Media Beat with David Sarachuk right here on Robinhood Radio every Friday. We rebroadcast it on the weekends and also during the noon hour next week. Robinhoodradio.com. Click on demand. Click on the Media Beat with David Sarachuk.